You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to trash since 1977.
How's everybody doing? The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. Trying to switch it up a little bit there. Trying to switch up that intro a little bit. Give it a little bit of flavor. A little bit of, I don't know, something. Something a little different there. Welcome back. It's Will and Sammy. We're here. No guests this week. It's just, you just get the regular guys. The boys at the GGTMC. we're back. We're going to talk about the Nickel Ride this week from 1974. One that I think Will's been trying to get on the show since, I don't know.
For life.
Since Caesar was in office. Something. It's been talked about for a long time. So we'll finally get to that, and you can hear our thoughts about it here in just a little bit. We hope everybody's doing well. Will, you doing good?
Yeah, I'm doing good, man. It's the tan's going. It's summertime. We're not snowed in. Life is good. Nice. What about you, Sammy?
Pretty good. I can't complain. There's not much to complain about, right? In the grand scheme of things, right. There's nothing to complain about. So yeah, I'm doing all right. Doing pretty good. We got a little bit of feedback. We're going to knock that out. We got a couple from Jacob, one from Walt. Sorry, guys, we haven't got to him in a while, but, we've had some interesting shows and scheduling conflicts. So been hard to get to him, but we're going to knock them out today, and I'm going to play them here as we go, starting right now, so we can get on these, and if I don't feel bad for missing your guys' feedback. So here we go. First one from Jake, then we'll do a Walt, then we'll do another Jake. Hopefully Jacob doesn't mind being called Jake, because he's being called Jake. Maybe he likes to be called Jack. I don't know. You know, I'm making an assumption there. So my apologies. Here we go.
Hey, gents, this is Jacob. I got a question for you. What actor is totally bona fide for you, and you will watch anything and everything that they put out, no matter how dreadful, or maybe director, that works too. I've noticed that Liam Neeson's action extravaganzas, which have definitely been the law of diminishing returns, they get worse and worse. I just watched Blacklight, and it was incredibly vanilla. And had a terrible ending, and yet I watched it. And he has yet another film, Memory, that is also probably not very good, but I will probably watch it. Another actor that I can't seem to get enough of their projects is Scott Adkins. He puts out like 10 movies a year, and I watch all of them to varying degrees of success. So what's your Scott Adkins or Liam Neeson? Thanks.
Yeah. There you go. That's not a super tough question, I don't think.
That's a good meatball down the middle for us to hit.
Yeah, definitely. You got anybody? Got actors, directors?
Yeah, I'll give one contemporary and one older. Contemporary Robert Pattinson, forgive me.
Okay.
I just think he's great in everything. He tends to pick good stuff. interesting stuff. I would also say Colin Farrell. They really pick good films. You can go so many ways with this. Like, I trust the stuff they pick because they seem to really care about their craft. Right?
Yeah.
Whereas you look at someone like Franco Nero, I'll watch anything he's in, and he's been in some junk.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Scott Adkins is a good one. I watched when he did The Accident Man. Not great. Definitely not terrible. Yeah. Some guys, yeah, you know what it is too. I feel like some actors, you catch them in a film, you adore them in, and they earn a lot of goodwill because of that one role. And I guess that would be an interesting follow-up question to Jake, or maybe he answered it with Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
What actors, or to anyone in our listeners, any of our listeners, what actors did you love in something and then they just dwindled, like their goodwill got burned up pretty quick. They were kind of a one-hit wonder. But anyway, yeah. Pattinson, yeah. Nero, there's my two.
Yeah, I think it's it really kind of comes down sometimes to just identifying with an actor. I don't know what it is, but some actors you just immediately identify with. De Niro was an early one for me. But I won't watch everything Robert De Niro does. Probably of the modern actors, guys like the ones you mentioned are pretty good. I wouldn't definitely not shy away from most of the stuff they pick anyway. We both talk about Oscar Isaac, so I'm sure that's just one you forgot. You probably would throw him in there too.
Oh, and absolutely. Him and also Chiwetel Ejiofor for the most part.
Yeah. He's one.
Isaac, absolutely.
Yeah. They're some of the big ones. You know, I tend to see the Denzel movies and things like that. I don't pursue them really, but they always kind of seem to happen for me. I don't know why. Liam Neeson, I did like Liam Neeson action movies there for a little while. I thought he had a little thing going, but they do seem like they've kind of fallen off the wayside quite a bit. Like they're just kind of, sadly, they just seem kind of lazy now, which is a shame. It really should, you know, they got a good market cornered there and they could keep going with it. But of course, I've probably seen almost everything Charles Bronson's done. I've probably seen almost everything. Man, I'm trying to think. I've seen there's a lot of actors I've seen everything. I've seen a lot of Tyrone Power films, which is an interesting actor, kind of old school actor there. A lot of Spencer Tracy films. I've seen a lot of Spencer Tracy stuff. I don't know. It's a good question. Directors, that one's easier for me. I tend to follow filmmakers probably more than actors, but even then, stuff slips through the cracks. We've talked about this before. Like, even Paul Thomas Anderson, who I was gushing about last week, I still haven't seen The Phantom Thread. So, I mean, it's the only one of his I haven't seen. Why I haven't seen it, I don't know. It just keeps slipping by me, you know what I mean? And certainly, of the new actors, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Don Lee and all of his fun action movies he's doing. And yeah, it's made me go look at a lot of his stuff. And he's a lot of fun. He's really, you know, middle-aged Korean action hero. Good stuff.
And he's just a bruiser. He's kind of like a Korean version of, if we had like a contemporary Bud Spencer.
Yeah. That's what right? He's kind of like. Yeah.
Lovable, yeah. Charismatic, just a bruiser. Directors are easier to follow, though. You're right. And I kind of left that point out. Directors are more blue chip.
Yeah.
I tend to feel like their quality is generally, if you love a director, you're going to watch everything they do.
Yeah.
Like you said, Paul Thomas Anderson, Almodovar, Malick. But in saying that, there's two or three Malicks I haven't seen recently.
Yeah. Yeah.
The new ones. Almodovar is the one guy. Those three come to mind immediately. Oh, Yorgos Lanthimos. But I was like you. I wasn't interested in seeing Phantom Thread. And then I saw it and it fucking knocked my socks off. I was like, why did I wait? It's Paul Thomas Anderson. But
yeah. I mean, you can really trust directors almost more than you can trust actors. But then again, I don't bemoan actors as much when they swing and miss, because actors are just doing the job that they're hired to do. So to me, they're not really involved in the filmmaking. So if the movie's bad, it's usually not the actor's fault. It's usually somebody else's fault. So
agent or the director.
Yeah, that, or maybe sometimes the writer, sometimes the studio itself. So there's many factors that kind of factor into a bad film, but we've all had that conversation, right? Where great performances in bad movies. I mean, I've seen some really great performances. I mean, there's some actors who are great in every single thing they're in, even if it's like a Transformers movie. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head, but I'm saying.
To say low, sort of low common denominator stuff. But yeah, I will much prefer, or I will trust a great director with a middling cast than I will a great cast with a middling director. Yeah. 7 days of the week.
Yeah.
I will take the great director with the quote unquote mediocre cast every day.
Yeah. Yeah. Me, I'm mostly the same way. All right. Thanks, Jake. He's going to have another question for us here in a little bit. So we'll do one here from Walt. Let's go here. Let's see what Walt's up to.
Gentlemen, it's Walt. I do not like pina coladas, but I do like getting caught in the rain.
There we go.
And, of course, I would never throw any fruits at the gentlemen of the Midnight Cinema. People are welcome to throw fruits at me. Of course, I love fruits. Now, you guys are Ollie Reed fans. Yes, of course.
There's one.
Now, this week's clip, saw this. Thought of you guys. Amazing clip just posted by the BBC on YouTube. Oliver Reed, 1977, at home. You can search for that. Oliver Reed walks around his giant estate, and you wonder how in the world this guy could keep such a place, even on his money. And spoiler alert, he couldn't. But you got to give him credit, a man who stuck to England, even under the heavy taxes of the 1970s. Thanks, guys.
I need to check that out. I've never seen the Ollie Reed's house.
That would be incredible. Ollie Reed is absolutely another one. Just tour de force.
Yeah. Talk about a guy that's awesome in bad movies. I mean, he's been in some bad movies, but he always is given 100%.
He brings it.
Yeah.
He brings it all the time.
I mean, he might not be aware that he's given 100% because he's blackout drunk half the time, but
yep.
He's definitely giving it a shot no matter what.
Wings Hauser comes to mind, another guy I've seen some garbage, but Wings just touches it, and a little more gold on that turd.
Yeah.
Gold flakes, if nothing else.
Robert Zadar is a good one, too. Yeah. We talk about Zadar and how underrated he was.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff. So, Walt, you're kind of keeping it going there, but I'm going to check out that clip. I got to see this huge estate Ollie lived.
Real.
I bet he probably doesn't. Well, he's gone now. Clearly, he doesn't remember it anymore, but I bet he probably didn't even remember half the stuff he did in that house.
That's a very...
That guy was a mess. All right. Another one from Jake. Here we go. He says, listen before playing. It's a hot take. I listened to it. I mean, it might be a little bit of a hot take, but it's not that hot. But we'll let everybody else decide what's hot and what's not. I sound like a rapper over here. Here we go. Playing this from Jake.
Hey, fellas, this is Jacob. A bit of a hot take here. I recently watched the Woodstock 99 documentary on HBO Max, and I saw a lot of parallels between that festival and Ozfest as far as the same demographics, the aggressive music. I went to Ozfest 99, and that was actually a tour that went all over the country. And there were not reported riots or a giant wave of terrible sexual assault that we saw at Woodstock 99. And actually in Woodstock, at Ozfest 98, Limp Bizkit played. So they were also kind of a convenient scapegoat. In my opinion, I think that Woodstock attracted an audience that didn't have a sense of identity, a sense of character, a sense of self. And so when one person started doing something terrible and bad, the others were more willing to take part simply because they didn't have their own central identity and character. What do you think?
Well, you bring up an interesting question here. I watched that documentary a long time ago. I was talking about it with Todd back in the day. And I really just believe things like this happen a lot of times because they're just a confluence of coincidences, and sometimes bad things just happen. I really do believe that. I think a lot of bands got a scapegoat thing for that. I mean, the music was aggressive and stuff, but I've been to a million aggressive music shows in my life. And I've never been to one that breaks out in riots like that one. So I don't think that has anything to do with it. I think it's just it's just something, as silly as this sounds, it's just something that was bound to happen at some point. And here's a little something that a lot of people don't want you to know about the original Woodstock. There was a lot of sexual assaults at that Woodstock, too. And it wasn't all hippy-dippy and romantic like they make it out to be. Read a little bit into to the original Woodstock. It was actually quite a gross affair. It was not what you think it was. I'll tell you that. So sometimes it just doesn't work out like you think it's going to. I have been to a few of these big open air festivals and stuff, and things have gotten kind of weird. best advice I always give people is when it starts to get weird, walk away. Because if not, things will just get worse. And, I mean, if you think you need to help somebody, but I advise you to walk away if you can walk away, because it'll, once you get about 5 or 10 people involved, it never works out good. Not for anybody. So I think it's just one of those weird pop culture moments, Jake. I just think that's all it was.
I don't have a lot of necessarily intelligent insight to add. I was dating a girl that went there at the time. I wanted no part of it. I was the right age. I was, I guess, 19.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to tread lightly here and not go too deep into this, but I think that part of the problem was some of the crowd that went there. You get a certain element, like frat boys, and I think at the time, culture, things have changed a lot in the past 20 years,
mm-hmm.
For the better. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of rotten people out there, certainly, but pop culturally, there was a real crest at the time, and a lot of the acts like Nirvana, a lot of the Seattle musicians, a lot of these people had crossed over. Limp Bizkit, all these people were getting a lot of radio play on top 40 stations at the time. I think you had a lot of jockey, frat boy types. And I say that as someone who kind of straddled the line between, I played a lot of sports, you know, was a jock, but also, you know, did drama and hung out with, you know, the skater kids and stoner kids and everything else. So I'm not saying that as someone who's just condemning jocks, but I just think you had that crest and you had kind of the wrong element there. But I don't know. I've been meaning to see that documentary. I think of that as a really – my snap reaction when I think about that festival is just what an ugly, ugly moment. But like you said, I do think that over time – there's other events that we look at through rose-colored glasses, i.e. the original, that,
yeah,
nostalgia softens that lens a little more than maybe it really would.
Well, I don't think it'll soften. The problem it was with Woodstock 99 is it won't ever soften, because so much of that – there was a lot of footage shot of Woodstock, but so much of the stuff that was really bad that happened there was either destroyed or never talked about, and it's in the ether now. It's just in the stories.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Woodstock 99, everybody had and I don't think everybody had camera phones, but there was a lot of footage, and MTV was there, and things were pretty crazy. And, it was just I'd honestly believe it was a confluence of bad events. Multiple things happened that transpired. I think a lot of bands took the blame because the music was aggressive at the time.
It was an easy scapegoat, right?
Yeah. Especially Limp Bizkit. For that matter, they really took the brunt of it. But some of those other bands did as well. But it is an interesting documentary to see, because it is an interesting kind of social experiment. And it's something you always have to be aware of. I mean, like I said, I've been to I don't know how many open air concerts and festivals, and it's always kind of in the background. There's something shady going on.
Yeah.
So you just kind of got to be, I mean, I think anytime you get a bunch of people together, ball games, anything.
It gets ugly.
It can get ugly pretty quick.
Yeah, absolutely. There is an element there. Same as you. I've been to everything from raves to NFL games where you peel back that layer and the ugliness is there to be found.
Oh, yeah. I haven't even taken my son to an NFL game because every experience I've ever had of one's been so dreadful. I won't go to them anymore.
I'll never go to with my kids. Some I will, of course. Some I definitely wouldn't.
Yeah.
Not naming any names, but.
Yeah.
Football fans, you know what ones they are.
But there's some like college sports here and where I'm at that we won't go to because it's just as bad. So. It's a pretty ugly business, and there ain't nothing you can do about it. Society's an ugly thing sometimes, and I just think, like I said, that was the perfect storm. Something was going to happen, and it did, and then there it was. So I know that sounds like a cheap way out, but I do honestly believe that. All right. Of course, it doesn't help that I think bottle of water was $12 a bottle that day.
It was, but I think it was, yeah.
Yeah, but I think if you go to any sports game now, I know the last time I took my son to a baseball game, I think I paid $15 for an icy or slushy or whatever, which is another reason why I don't really go to sporting events anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's ridiculous. This is what they, I mean, they just rip you off. But yeah, that is a good question. And it's an interesting social. I think the best thing about that documentary, again, is the social dynamics of it. They play a lot with the race card in that documentary, if I remember. And I find that kind of funny because, you know, one of the people that was pushing the race thing so much, I remember DMX was there and he was using the N-word a lot. And he was getting all these white people to say the N-word back at him. So he was really pushing those buttons to do that. And then to sit there and say that all these kids are racist when you got this African-American rapper up there asking people to repeat after him. It's kind of silly to me, but, you know, that's the society we live in now. So, you know, it is what it is. I enjoyed DMX somewhat, but I thought he was a bit of a dummy. So it just, you know, interesting social experiment. That's the way I look at it. And again, read about the original Woodstock. Trust me, it'll blow your mind. If you think it's just what you've heard in the film, it is way more than that. A lot of bad stuff went down there. Okay, let's get into what we've been watching. You got anything? You been watching anything lately?
Yeah, I watched a few things. I've been overly prolific, but watched a few things.
All right. What you got?
Not much at all, actually. I watched... again, there's going to be a little bit of a mix here of TV.
Yep.
To go with our, you know, our films, because frankly, TV is just kind of long form film, it feels like now, right? So I decided on the weekend to kind of tick one off that I know my cousin's a big fan of, and I've always meant to see it being a big Borgnine fan, 1955's Marty.
Oh, good old Marty. I saw you watch this, yeah.
Yeah, this is a good one. It's a sweet film.
Yeah.
It's a tender film, right? Mm-hmm. There's certain filmmakers like Douglas Sirk, as much as he makes kind of subtly scathing melodrama sometimes, there is a certain tenderness to some of his work. And this film is very much a tender film. And I like that it takes two people kind of, not marginalized, but two lonely people that aren't sort of conventionally beautiful. They find each other. And it's a sweet, effective film. And I'm glad we get to see Borgnine shine, which... we got to see a lot in supporting roles, but he's wonderful in this.
Yeah, yeah, he got the Oscar, right?
He did.
Which is weird, because it was a TV film, I think. It was one of those kind of... I think it might have been a TV film. It might have been.
I could be wrong, though.
I think it ended up getting a theatrical release, but I think it was originally made for television.
Okay, that may be so, yeah. But yeah, that was good. Started watching Umbrella Academy Season 3... we like it so far. You know, we're about three episodes in. It's one we've watched from the beginning. This show, it's funny. It's kind of broad in spots where I kind of roll my eyes, but there's still enough highs that it works for me. You know, some of the cast is quite good. Our guy Bobby Sheehan's always a high spot. So, yeah, good stuff. Other than that, really just one more thing. Started Ms. Marvel.
Oh, yes.
With Braden, and I got to say, we love this. I mean, we're only one episode in, but this is so much fun. Aesthetically, it just has an energy. This, for me, right now, it's, other than Scarlet Witch, it might be my favorite thing they've done as a TV show. And that's a lot. I mean, I'm one episode in, but I just think, oh man, the energy, it's really fun, really fun. And I hope it finds a big audience because it's a hoot.
Yeah. Looks like I might've been wrong. Looks like it was produced. That version was produced for a film, but it was originally based on a TV program,
which I was going to say, cause I thought I saw that it had been done. Yeah.
And I think,
teleplay or something.
Yeah,
or,
Steiger played Marty in that version.
Yes, that's right, because I'd seen that. I thought, oh, wow, interesting. Steiger would have been an interesting Marty, too. So
yeah, he would have been.
Yeah, as long as he doesn't do that, that Mexican accent from DocuSucker.
Yeah, that's a rough one. All right, so is that everything?
That's everything, man. Nothing too cool deep cuts, but what did you get into?
I got into a few things. Had a little bit of time lately, so... checked out Chernobyl, The Lost Tapes.
Yes.
This is on HBO Max. This is pretty good. Shows some footage I've never seen before. Actual footage of them up on the roof trying to shovel off this high radiation type material. This is not for the weak stomach, though. I need to warn people if they're going to watch this. You see what radiation poison and damage really does to a human body. So it's pretty gross. And, yeah, not for the faint of heart. And, you know, they show a lot of the children that are born after and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty rough. So just be warned. But it's very interesting. I'll say that. And the way that, you know, the government over there covered it up. I think people think that American government's the only one that covers up anything. But trust me, it's pretty much any. It's pretty much any government.
Yeah.
It's just you got to dig. You got to dig. Or they got to make a mistake. One of the others got to happen. Landon wanted to keep going on the Pirates run, so we did Dead Man's Chest. That's the second one. I feel the same way about this one as I did the first time I watched it. I like all the Davy Jones stuff.
Yep.
The Bill Nighy, Davy Jones octopus head thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's fun. The way he talks and everything. It's so original and kind of strange and obtuse and just a weird performance. Even out weirds Johnny Depp's performance, and some of the special effects hold up really well, but man, these Pirates movies, both of them are just, they're so much of a slog. They're just so slow. And I just find them so not exciting. So we struggled through that one, but we made it. I thought Landon was going to pass out at some point, but he made it through. He wants to hold tight, though. I guess he's going to see it through. So that means I've seen the third one. I don't think I've ever seen the fourth and the fifth one. Matter of fact, I didn't even know there was five of them. I thought there was only four of them. So I'm kind of dreading that a little bit, but we'll see what happens. Maybe one of them's a diamond in the rough. I don't know. We'll see.
Might be more rough than diamond.
Yeah, it might be. Yeah, well, I feel like there's going to be a lot of barnacles going through this. This coral reef of films here. But you know, he does enjoy the Johnny Depp performance, which I understand. It's a funny performance, and I think he will get tired of it, but you know, it is a good performance. I mean, there's a reason why these movies made money. And they do look expensive. I'll say that. I mean, they just look like they cost hundreds of millions of dollars, these movies. Yeah. Watch Quigley Down Under. You guys can, I won't talk much about that. You can hear me on the Not a Bomb Show talk about that. Probably the same week you hear this. So just listen for that on Wednesday. But they asked me to be on for that one, so I'm talking about Quigley Down Under, a little Tom Selleck Western action. Speaking of sports, still working on catching up with all the... They don't make as many 30 for 30s as they used to, but I still got a few that I'm trying to catch up on. Shark, this one's about Greg Norman. Or as like I said, I joked around with William Freakin' say, Shark!
you nailed it, man.
Shark. This one's pretty good. Talks about his kind of infamous, they called it choking at the Masters in 96. But
I remember that.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting story. And he's an interesting guy. Maybe not for everybody, certainly. So I'm not, that doesn't mean because I think he's an interesting guy, I'm championing anything or his politics or anything. I'm just saying he's an interesting fellow. Speaking of interesting fellows, Anthony Bourdain, Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain.
Love this.
Yeah, this was really good. I watched this today. It was really good. It really was. You know, it's really fascinating to watch this kind of, you know, sadly, this kind of natural deterioration of somebody's mental health. And, you know, everything he tried to do and then didn't try to do to get out of it. And, you know, it's a sad story, but a somewhat poignant and beautiful one as well. Yeah. But yeah, it's a fascinating look at a lot of things, culture, just the idea of that show and what it became. I don't know. It's fascinating. I never was a huge Anthony Bourdain fan. I mean, I like some of his writing and stuff. I definitely like that. I don't think I ever watched the show really, because I think when I originally watched the show, it was back when it first came out. It was really just I remember the first episodes really just being kind of like one of these, I'm going to travel somewhere and eat something exotic, you know? So he was eating like rattlesnake hearts and things like this. And I was like, well, I'm not really into that. But I know the show changed quite a bit over the years and kind of became more of a travelogue show with just kind of food as a background thing.
Engaging with the cultures and the people, the slice of life stuff. It focused more on that. It's, yeah. huge, I guess, deeper, more meaningful human connections, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which, you know, may have actually lent itself to some of his problems, right? Because he was around, you know, people who weren't as fortunate as he was.
Yep.
And I did find it interesting, though, you know, his addiction to travel, his addiction to running, which is essentially what, you know, people who can't stay home and they have to travel all the time. I mean, there is this theory that they're running from something all the time. So maybe he was running from something all the time and maybe it finally caught up with him. So really good, though. I really did like it quite a bit. It was very good. The only other thing I've watched, I started something, but I haven't finished it yet, but I did watch today. I did catch Gaspar Noé's Vortex. I did check this out. So this is Dario Argento, and I can't remember the actress of the other name. And this is Noé's film about dementia. Françoise Laburun is the name of the female actress. And then Dario plays the husband. And this movie is a totally different type of Noé. Noé had a bad brain hemorrhage about 5 or 6 years ago. He almost died. So he sobered up. I don't think he does drugs or alcohol anymore at all. So he wanted to make a movie about, you know, life and the fading and everything else and how we fade sometimes into our old age. It's very much similar to, what's his name's film? Haneke's film in a lot of ways. Yeah, it's similar to that in a lot of ways. That one's a little harsh, but this one's also quite harsh in some ways and quite scary and terrifying and stuff. And it's really good. I mean, it's an interesting experiment, though, because it's shot in split screen. So there's two stories going on at once the whole time. So that might throw some people off. It can be a lot to take in. You got the Dario Argento point of view, and you got the Françoise Laburun point of view. She's got advanced dementia, and he's struggling really hard to deal with it. So you get kind of two different sides of that coin. And then their son and their grandson's involved as well a little bit. It's not transgressive or anything at all like that. I think what I came away from with it, though, it's a really interesting experiment. Not Noé's best work. But yeah, Dario Argento can really act. He's really quite good in this film. I thought it was funny. I don't want to say anything because it gives it away. It gives a spoiler away. So I won't. But he said he would only do the film if Noé gave his character a certain something plot point. And it's like such a strange thing for him to put into the movie that it's like, okay, that's a Dario Argento thing. And so I'd imagine Noé just being like, okay, well, he's Dario Argento, guys. I kind of got to give him this one. So, and an interesting choice to put him in there anyway. So, yeah, it's really good. But the word I would use, be warned, folks, unless you're a Noé fan, it's extremely challenging.
Emotionally or sort of technically?
Challenging in that it really is kitchen sink drama, so not a lot happens. There's a lot of talking, and there's a lot of deep, deep, deep conversation, and a lot of moments where nothing is happening. I mean, this movie has long 5, 6, 7 minute takes of Dario Argento sleeping. So it's very challenging. So be warned. But not challenging in the way you think Noé's films typically are.
Not confrontational.
Certainly not confrontational, not transgressive, not aggressive in any way. This is easily the softest thing he's ever done. And I think it might just be because, again, he almost died about 6 or 7 years ago. He had a major brain hemorrhage of some sort. I can't remember what happened, but
yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and he was on his deathbed, so he really thought he wasn't going to pull through. So he came through, and he wanted to make something kind of optimistic and cheery. So he decides to make a film about two older people falling into dementia, which isn't really that cheery. But I guess for Gaspar Noé, I guess that's as good as you're going to get. So anyway. This is it's a fascinating film. It would not probably make like a top 10 list for me because, again, the split screen storytelling is challenging. The story is challenging. The acting is really good. There's a lot of experimentation going on here too. I mean, he certainly has not lost his ability to provoke filmgoers with experimentation. And I think he's going to frustrate some people with this one. So, but, you know, again, if you like Gaspar Noé, though, I think you should check it out. And you like Love, right? Gaspar Noé's Love. You like Love. I'm pretty sure
you love Love. I think about that film often, actually.
Yeah.
Because there's a sort of wistful melancholy that resonated with me when I saw it. Again, you and I talked about this, how there was a through line with his films where they became less angry and more melancholy and wistful progressively.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
To focus on a tragic moment in someone's life that forever alters or takes away the happiness in their life.
Yeah.
All of his films have this.
Yeah, 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 yeah. They're all in there. I mean, he is. I mean, Climax is film before this,
which I didn't see yet either.
Yeah, that one has some general human ugliness in it, but it's not shock. Well, no, I guess some of it is shocking, and some of it is heartbreaking, no doubt, and it's very challenging. But again, when I think of Gaspar Noé, challenging is the word that I would use first and foremost all the time. He is totally unique. There's no other filmmaker like him. Even seeing this film, I mean, even using the split screen, I expected it to be in something like, you know, like De Palma or like Sisters or stuff like that. This is totally unique the way he uses it. It's really interesting. But again, I would not recommend this to people who spend most of their time watching Marvel films or something. No. This is not your movie. You would hate me if I told you to check this out. you wouldn't. No.
Oh,
I was gonna say. No. Like I said, you liked Love, and that's as close, even though that does have hardcore pornography in it, that's as close as I can think of his last three films, Love, Climax, and Vortex. While some of it's transgressive, they've kind of got like a almost like a trilogy type feel to them. So they kind of feel like all part of some transition he's going through. So it'll be interesting to see what he does next. It's always interesting to see what he does because he really is one of the treasures cinematically. All right.
I agree 100%.
We're going to take a short break, come back and talk about the Nickel Ride. We'll be back right after this. That song, first of all, it's got the word rat in it, but it just reminded me of this movie a little bit.
I could see that, man. I can see that.
It's got a nice little feel to it there.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. All right. The Nickel Ride, 1974. Again, like I said in the opening to the show, the intro, so to speak, Will has been trying to get this film on the show for, man, a long time. And we just never have been able to... Well, I mean, we could have made it happen, right? But things just kind of come up and other films happen. And it just is what it is. Again, there's things we haven't covered. People are still like, I can't believe you guys haven't covered that. It seems like you guys covered that. I'm like, no, we actually never did. But,
yeah, and there's films, yeah, we always meant to, just never have. Welcome to Dong Mak Gaul has been on our roadmap before we ever started the show. And that hasn't even been thought up since I just mentioned it. So
there we go. The Nickel Ride, 1974, PG, rated PG. This is the era of the PG grown-up American film. Directed by one Robert Mulligan. We'll talk about him in a little bit. Talk about Eric Roth, the writer. And we'll talk about the actors in the film. Jason Miller. The return of Linda Haynes to the show.
Yes, since episode one.
Yeah. And I may have finally discovered why Linda Haynes sounds funny to me when she talks.
I knew this was going to be a topic.
Yeah. Thick-tongued Linda, we called her back in episode one.
Yes.
Pardon our political incorrectness, but that's what we called her. Anyway, Victor French is in here. Bo Hopkins. Now, we did not time this to Bo Hopkins passing away. He passed away just 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And if you like Bo Hopkins, you really should see The Nickel Red.
Oh, man.
You really should.
Might be Bo Hopkins' finest hour.
It's a pretty fun Bo Hopkins turn. And oddly, his name is Turner. So there we go. How about that? Yeah, so this is a very, I would say, underseen crime film from the 70s. Kind of a neo-noir type deal.
Yep.
Robert Mulligan, for those of you who don't know, probably mostly known for To Kill a Mockingbird.
For sure. His place in Hollywood history is cemented with that one, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's pretty much a sealed deal that he will always be remembered for To Kill a Mockingbird. But he has made quite a few really good films.
I agree.
He really has. You got To Kill a Mockingbird, like I said. You got Baby the Rain Must Fall, which is a Steve McQueen film that I totally recommend people check out. It's a weird one. Stalking Moon, which is a really good kind of Western thriller with Gregory Peck. I definitely recommend people check that out. He even did a horror film in 72 called The Other, which is a evil twin film. We got to cover that at some point. That'd be fun.
Yep.
And he did Clara's Heart and Kiss Me Goodbye and stuff same time next year toward the back end. Then he finished out his career in 91 with the Reese Witherspoon starring The Man in the Moon, which is a really good film and a hell of a film to go out on. Really a great film. His last film was really... I mean, The Man in the Moon, it's a really solid movie.
I just want to shout out another film of his that I've probably talked about on the show over the years.
Yeah.
Just to show his diversity, and I'm a fan of it. It's Love with the Proper Stranger.
Right, right. I was going to mention that because I remember that you brought it up once before, and I can't remember why you brought it up. I guess it's like you and your mom used to watch it a few times or something like that?
So my dad, just his girl was always Natalie Wood.
Ah, yeah, okay, there you go.
My mom and I watched this one day. It was on TCM, and it was like McQueen, and it's like a tender McQueen.
Yeah, right?
Like it's a love. You know, it's one of those kind of sweet '60s kind of romance films, like we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's a good film, right? I mean,
it is.
You know, he's still, again, wistful, right? Like he's an interesting filmmaker. You know, one that doesn't look like he's aged well, but I've always meant to check out his Blood Brothers.
Hmm.
It's him. It's Richard Gere, Tony LoBianco, Paul Sorvino, Mary Lou Henner, Robert Englund. It's where I think he got his nose busted up. But apparently it hasn't aged well because it's about an Italian family in New York City. And apparently it's a little too broad with the Italian stuff. Like it's
looks like Sorvino and LoBianco or might be the only Italians in the movie.
Yeah, it's funny, man, between... Good Bar and Blood Brothers. Early on, Gere was playing Italians. Weird.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was, you know, a little dark hair and.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Stereotypical, right? I mean, kind of the look.
Mm-hmm.
But this is The Nickel Ride. Now, The Nickel Ride comes after, I believe, he does the horror film I was talking about.
Yeah,
and he had done a couple other films in there. One I haven't ever seen, Summer of 42, and The Pursuit of Happiness is in there as well, Stalking Moon. I still have not seen Up the Down Staircase nor Inside Daisy Clover, so I don't know anything about those. But The Nickel Rag comes along in 74. He teams up with Eric Roth. Eric Roth wants to make a neo-noir film. He just kind of writes this movie, and they put it together. And Jason Miller's coming off of The Exorcist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's hot. And there's thoughts in Hollywood that maybe he could be the next big star.
Yep.
And the kind of fun, interesting story behind the scenes about this is that Mulligan and Miller were actually going to do Taxi Driver. They had actually optioned Paul Schrader's script, and they were going to do that. Can you imagine that, Taxi Driver?
Marvel What If. Like, that's incredible. That's...
Yeah, that would be crazy, wouldn't it?
See, Mulligan, I like Mulligan as a filmmaker. I do. That would have been a different film.
Yeah. Oh, man, that would have been a totally different film. I mean, I can see Miller as Travis Bickle. I can kind of see it. He's got this kind of quiet intensity.
I don't think he has quite the same edge
that
a young De Niro would bring, but Miller is a tremendous actor.
Yeah, there's a level of danger with young De Niro.
100%.
What's amazing is when I was doing some research on this movie to talk about it, I was looking at Jason Miller's birth date, and I realized he's only like 34, 35 years old in this movie.
And he looks about 45, 50.
Man, he looks old. He looks rough. And, you know, the guy died at 61. He had a lot of alcohol problems, and he struggled. He was a real artist.
Loved the theater, loved the stage, right?
Yeah. And movies were never really a big thing for him, but, you know, he kind of caught himself in a big one and you know, had a chance to kind of parlay that into some starring roles. But unfortunately, this movie did not perform at the box office. And I don't think he really ever tried to star in anything again. He was in stuff, but I don't think he ever tried to star in anything again because he felt like he was kind of snake bit by the whole ordeal.
Well, and that's the unfortunate thing in all this, right? Like, he's got some interesting stuff in there. Mm-hmm. A film that we adore, that's kind of a staple of our show, The Ninth Configuration, right?
Yeah. Yes, he's in there. He's also in a really fun movie we'll talk about someday because I think I'll probably pick it. I don't want to pick it anytime soon because I know somebody that talked about it on another podcast, so I don't want to mention it out loud. But okay. It's a really wacky idea for a movie. It really stands out in his filmography. I'll just tell you to look at 1977, and it's not the one with Devil in the title. Anyway, but he's really good as this kind of fixer character, this kind of guy that works. He's kind of a mid-level mob guy. And what I like about this movie, and I think you might agree, is this is the kind of blue-collar mob movie. This is not so much about Italians, Greeks, blah, 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 heritage and stuff like that. This is more about business.
It's the working class. It's the garbage men. It's the plumbers.
Yeah.
It's the working class of organized crime.
Yeah, the guys that own the warehouses. So what's important here is that Jason Miller owns all this property with these warehouses on it, and he lets these mob guys use this warehouse space for stolen goods. But he also helps with things like fights, fixing fights, and sports bets and things like that.
Anywhere a buck can be made.
Anywhere a buck can be made. And he makes a pretty good living at it, but it's taken a toll on him. And you can see that. And I think that's the genius of the Jason Miller casting in this film is that he is only 35 years old, but he does look like he's 45, maybe even going on 55, because he's so wore down by the worry.
Oh, man, the weariness, the fatigue. Yeah.
Always looking over his back. And this movie does play with 70s paranoia quite well. It's something it does really well, and we'll kind of talk about that. But, yeah, he plays a character named Cooper, and you hear that a lot in here. Cooper says this. Cooper says this. And you don't know who Cooper is, and then finally you meet Cooper, and you're like, well, he doesn't seem like he's that much, but he's obviously a really smart guy. I don't know if there's very many movies we've done on the show, and it's crazy to say this out loud, but if there's very many movies that feel more 70s than this movie does.
it feels very 70s, very late, early 70s.
Uh-huh.
It's that era, like we talked about, when everyone looked 10 years older than they really were because they were eating red meat, drinking scotch, and smoking all the time.
Yeah. Everybody was living their best life. They were just going for it, man.
Man.
And they were, you know, aging out. But, of course, then again, back then, everybody thought, you know, if you make it to 60, you're lucky. So if you're 35, you're already halfway there.
Shit. Yeah.
And people started families younger back then, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of reasons for all that. But, you know, it is true. I mean, nobody really feels young in this film. Everybody kind of feels, I guess Linda Haynes sort of does, but she feels like she's kind of been around the block a little bit. Like she's maybe it was a former working girl or a carny of some sort. There's some joking about carnies in here and talking about, you know, the grift and the carny game and everything else. So you feel like Cooper comes from that world, which would make sense because that transitions sometimes into crime.
Yep.
So there's some of that in here. This is shot in L.A. And it's not like L.A. you ever really see. Really, the only reason why you'd even know it's L.A. is because some of it, you can see palm trees in the background, but it really feels like, you know, middle America, or something like that. So it's a different side of L.A., and I kind of appreciated that because it wasn't really very – it wasn't the glory-filled L.A. streets, you know what I mean? And there's this one block they kind of shoot the majority of the film on, and it's almost like this deserted block, like, you know, poverty has gotten into this part of town or whatever, and, like, no, there's only a few stores open, bars, cheap office space. Obviously, Cooper owns these warehouses nearby. So people have moved away because crime has moved in. So it's kind of interesting to see that side of L.A. And the story kind of goes along, and, you know, basically what kind of kicks this off is Cooper has to fix a fight. The guy he wants to fix a fight with, he's a bit of a dullard, but he doesn't really want to fall. Take a seat is what they say. You need him to sit down. He doesn't want to do it, but Cooper thinks he's got him, talks him into it, and then the guy doesn't throw the fight. In the confluence of this, during the process, one of his, maybe his boss or maybe the guy he reports to, however you want to look at it, kind of introduces him to this cowboy character, this southern, maybe Texas. They don't really say, but they just call him a cowboy-like character, and Bo Hopkins, Turner character. And Turner's basically trying to learn the ropes and learn the business and everything else, and they really feel like he's an up-and-comer. And it's Bo Hopkins being very Bo Hopkins. He's happy-go-lucky. He's wearing the cowboy hat, the Canadian tuxedo. He's really having a good time here.
Yeah, lots of patches on all of his jackets.
Yeah. And he's menacing, but at the same time, entertaining. So what it reminds me of the most, it's a very Quentin Tarantino-type performance.
And I'm trying to think of a parallel here performance-wise where he's polite, he defers to Cooper a lot, he goes out of his way to kind of fawn over Cooper. But there is that underlying menace that Hopkins does so well. And part of it comes from physically, Miller seems very slight
compared
to Hopkins. Hopkins is a big man. You know, Cooper, we get the sense, to me, he's a little bit smaller in stature than Hopkins. And it's funny to see the juxtapositioning of what we're seeing on the surface and what is underlying, that Cooper's perceiving, that Mulligan is trying to convey through Turner. And it's a really nice kind of cat and mouse.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Really, really enjoy.
Yeah. It's real subtle, and Hopkins will go away and then he'll come back, and you're always kind of like, okay, well, maybe he's really, you know, being genuine, and it feels that way. And, some stuff kind of pays off later. But, man, it really is one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when Cooper, Jason Miller's character, kind of realizes, okay, I've had a good run, but it's clear I got a shelf life. Like, my run is over. I'm not making money for the boys anymore. And if you can't make money for them, they don't have any use for you.
No.
Because it's a business first. And
done for me lately.
Yeah. And he's not making money for him. He's not making things happen. He knows as well as we do from just seeing enough mob movies or seeing enough or hearing enough crime stories that if you're not making money, then you're no use to them. And you know all this information, then they're going to get rid of you because you're not contributing anymore, really. So they're not going to keep you around. So he knows he's in trouble. He knows he's got some things up against him. But what really makes the movie kind of interesting is they work in the kind of 70s paranoia angle. There's a great scene with him driving Linda Haynes to the country house and kind of freaking out about the cars. Everybody he sees, he kind of is on his back heels, you know, with everything. He's really up against it. Although I do think they come back from the lake or something at one point and they come in, there's footprints in the house. And there's a great scene of silence and stuff, and he's checking the house and everything. And then they realize there's nobody in the house. And he's like, well, you stay here. I'm going to go get new locks. I don't know if I would have left. I think I would have taken her with me.
Yeah, that's like the let's split up and we'll meet back here in a horror movie. Yeah.
It was a strange move. It was a very strange move. Like, Linda Haynes was brave because I wouldn't have done that. I'd been like, hell no, I'm going with you. I ain't staying here. But so Linda Haynes, we talked about her a long time ago on Rolling Vengeance. And I always thought, you know, we joked about it then. And again, I don't mean any slight toward anybody that has a speech impediment whatsoever. I really don't. But I always had trouble understanding her in Rolling Thunder. Well, I had trouble understanding her in this film too. And I'm like, why do I not understand Linda Haynes? What is wrong with me? Come to find out, Linda Haynes is actually Swedish. So English is actually her second language.
Really?
I didn't know this until this week. So lo and behold, the whole time I thought maybe she had a speech impediment. Really, all it is I think it's her accent and certain words she just kind of struggles to get out.
I'll say this. She was born in Florida, man. She's not Swedish.
Well, I could have swore somebody told me she was Swedish. I could have swore I read that somewhere.
She's Floridian.
Well, there's not much difference between the two.
No. She's Floridian through and through. But I'll say this. I don't want to say she became a punchline for us, but it became a bit of a running joke. And not to discredit her or seem dismissive of her work, but I'm glad we had a chance to watch this and reassess her critically, because you know who she reminds me of, sort of the working man's version of in this? Because I think she's great in this, is it's almost like she's like the working man's version of Tuesday Weld.
Yeah.
Or like Tuesday Weld and Thief, right? Like
uh-huh.
A little younger, obviously, than Weld is in that. But, you know, same with – but then again, Miller's character, even though he's younger, is a little old, seems older than he is. But I think she puts in a really great performance, and her and Miller have a really easy lived-in chemistry together.
Yeah, she's in these really kind of interesting 70s films.
Yeah.
This one, Coffee – Rolling Thunder, I mean, and stuff like The Drowning Pool.
Uh-huh.
And even toward the end of her career, I think she did Brubaker with Robert Redford and stuff. So, and I remember she was in a Jim Jones movie, because I remember watching that with my parents. It was a TV movie. So she was around. I can remember her being around stuff, but she never really kind of caught fire, for whatever reason. So, I mean, she had a good run, but she just never really kind of caught, you know, major fire for whatever reason. But she'll probably be mostly always remembered for either Rolling Thunder, or she would maybe be remembered more for this movie maybe than Rolling Thunder, but this movie is just not available. I think Shout Factory put it out on a DVD as part of a combo pack with that Frankenheimer. I think it's Frankenheimer film 99 and
it's dead or whatever.
44 and /100 dead or whatever that film is called.
Ridiculous title.
Yeah, it's got a ridiculous title, but I think there's a double DVD out there of this film and that film.
What a shame, though. Like, how has Criterion or Kino Lorber or someone not picked this up?
I don't know. It's kind of interesting to me. Criterion, I could see maybe kind of going away from it unless they can get some people to talk about it. I know Quentin Tarantino's a huge fan of this film.
Big fan of this.
So it seems like he would push it in some way. But Kino Lorber is a really good example. When you brought up Kino, this thing feels like it's tailor made for a Kino Lorber release.
Big time.
And it's kind of amazing that it's not been picked up in any way. I mean, I will go on record and say this is one of the great lost 70s crimes films that nobody has seen. And when I say nobody, I just mean it's not generally brought up in conversation. I'm sure there's more than a handful of us, and those of you listening who have seen this film. But I'm telling you right now, nobody talks about this movie. And it is a very solid crime film. One of the better crime films of the 70s, to be honest with you.
Yep.
And one of the better neo-noirs of that time period. And it really is a shame that it hasn't, you know, kind of garnered the reputation it kind of deserves. It really is a shame. I mean, that's the best I can say about it. I mean, it sounds like I'm being kind of flippant about it, but I'm not. I mean, it's amazing to me. It's never caught on. All I can think is, you know, Jason Miller he didn't set the box office on fire. He just, for whatever reason, he just didn't have that oomph. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And again, I just think it's too bad. The decade we look at it as, and you know, we're far from the only ones, but 70s American filmmaking, this just encapsulates so much of what we love in the 70s American films. And it's funny that, you know, to get back to the whole Criterion or how this hasn't become sort of critically reassessed, is you look at, you know, a film that this really reminds me of, having now sat back and watched it again, is Friends of Eddie Coyle.
Yeah. It's a lot like that film.
Which that film, and rightfully so,
People
fawn over it. Criterion put it in a nice release. But they're very similar in terms of time passing people by, the principals in it by. the generational nature of things, mortality, just, you know, legacy or lack thereof. You know, your life's been misspent, and the sort of the grim realization of these characters.
Right.
And it's just like the average man's grim realization. It's, I work in the underworld, and that realization is coupled with the fact that I'm probably going to be killed by someone.
Mm.
So it kind of has this double whammy, right? And yeah, it's just weird that it hasn't gotten the love that it should. You know, Miller just nails it.
Yeah, he shines in this movie. I mean, he really does.
He carries. And you talked about some of the principles in front of the camera, but behind the camera, because like we said, you know, Haynes is fantastic. Victor French, who I'm going to be totally honest with you, I love French in this as kind of his buddy. I didn't even realize that was French. Like it was Victor French of Highway to Heaven fame, Little House on the Prairie fame.
Yeah. That Victor French.
So we get two like childhood TV heavyweights here. We get Victor French and we get John Hillerman from Magnum PI.
Yeah.
As mob boss.
Yeah. What's the odds that I watch a John Hillerman film and a Tom Selleck film in the same week and they're not in the film together?
Not in it together. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. But I digress here. So,
Eric Roth, too, who I was going to talk about. Now, Eric Roth, who wrote this, I mean, this is early in his career. Eric Roth is, you know, he's written Dune. He wrote Dune, the screenplay for the
Onion Field, which he's been on the show before. The Wolfen.
Yeah, Wolfen, he worked on that. And he's got the Killers of the Flower Moon coming out, which is Scorsese's Apple TV movie.
Big thing. Ali, Munich, Good Shepherd, Benjamin Button.
Yeah, I mean, he's a hell of a writer. And he's been writing the whole time. And you could see that here all the way back. So one of the things that you got to be prepared for with this movie is very dialogue heavy. And I watched it on YouTube, and it's not the cleanest print in the world. It's quite fuzzy. But it's good. It's watchable. But the audio's not super great either. So
no, and not a film like this, you really need it to be. But the other thing is, I want to talk about is the cinematographer for this.
Oh, Jordan, yeah.
One of with heavy hitter. Again, Brewster McCloud, Touch of Satan, Nickel Ride, Rolling Thunder, Cutter's Way, Blade Runner.
Yeah.
I worked with Peggy Sue Got Married.
Some big ones.
State of Grace.
Yeah, man.
You got some really talented people involved in this film. Edited. This film's edited really well. And to get back to the way it's shot for a second, not to jump around too much, Sammy, you butt in too much, but
no, it's okay.
I love how this film conveys a lot with the way it's shot, in that the frame's always crowded. There's always lots of people, and it just adds to Cooper just never being alone, never having that solitude or that peace, right? Like there's always action. The frames are always crowded with 10 people and noise and chatter. And it does a good job of conveying how fatigued he would be at that.
Right. Right. I mean, that's the thing I come away from this movie. I mean, it just feels like if you want people to not be criminals, this is a good movie to watch. I mean, there's no positivity. Everything is so dreadful in this movie. And it's the reality of being a criminal. It's work. It's hard work. And you're dealing with the scum of the earth, and you're part of the scum of the earth. So it's a really good example of all that. And there's some shocking moments of violence in the film as well, which I think will shock people, because I don't think you'll see them coming.
No. And you know what else this reminds me of?
I'm done, by the way. You can just kind of roll with what you got.
I'm going to make this quick. You know what else this reminds me of is like a West Coast Sidney Lumet 70s film.
Yes. Yeah. I think Mulligan and Pakula were friends, right? I think they were producing partners at one point.
Well, there you go.
And it definitely has some Pakula elements as well.
Yeah. It does.
All three of those guys, though. Yeah. Mulligan, Lumet, and Pakula. I mean, though, that's very 70s. Right there.
Very, very 70s. And I love it.
And when I think about those three guys, paranoia thrillers is something I think about.
Yeah, they're just entrenched in paranoia, right?
Mm-hmm.
I talked about Haynes and Miller and Hopkins, right? Like Miller, the remarkable thing about Miller's performance here, Sammy, that we keep going Miller, but he does need to get his flowers for this because he gives a great performance in and of itself. He gives great performances opposite his love interest, Linda Haynes. Mm-hmm. He gives a great performance opposite his antagonist, Bo Hopkins. He gives a great performance opposite his best friend in the film, Patty.
Yeah.
All those exchanges are wonderful in the film.
Yeah, I don't think there's a missed note by Miller in the whole film.
No.
Like it might be one of the best downtrodden crime performances I've ever seen.
Well, that's the thing. Like Miller does so much with silence too. In the moments he's silent in the film.
Yeah, he reminds me. He's not as funny or as sardonic, but he reminds me a lot of the Max Cherry performance by Robert Forster. And Jackie Brown?
Well, in that he acts a lot without saying anything.
Yeah.
He conveys what we as the viewers understand him to be thinking or what we perceive him to be thinking in a scene when he's acting with no talking, well, the person opposite him in the scene is talking.
Right.
Yeah, and that's that weariness of a different kind that, Cherry, that Forrester brings, right? Where he's processing and understanding the magnitude of things by being silent.
Right. Like, his character is weary, too, but it's because he deals with all these bad people all the time. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens. I mean, he just becomes this weary, kind of beat-up guy who's close to retirement, doesn't have a love life. Mm-hmm. And it feels like Miller's character in this, Cooper, he wants to walk away from all this, and he wants to have the normal life too. But he's hung around one beat too long. Like he's just hung around too long, and now he's paying for it.
You know what this film is? This film is the 70s crime film version of that Y.A. Tittle iconic photograph.
Yeah.
Where just life comes at you fast.
Uh-huh.
One moment you're on top. The next moment you have lost your grip and you don't know how to get it back, if you can get it back, and then you realize you're not getting it back, it's over.
Yeah, I agree.
Battered and bloodied and neurotic and mistrusting of the institutions that you've built up and relied on for, 20, 30 years. So, very interesting. Miller does a good job channeling Pacino in one scene with Hopkins when him and Hopkins first meet, and he goes, "Oh, the key man. They mention you alongside Muhammad Ali and Bill Russell, and
he
mentions someone else." And
I love how subtle the keys are too. The keys are always kind of there,
yeah,
but then they become this kind of central focus toward like the last 10-15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
And what's great about that? What's a genius touch about that is the keys are almost like Miller's character. He's always aware of the keys, but there's not a sense of frantic or urgency with where the keys are. The deeper into the film we go, the more frantic and urgent he is when looking for the keys or making sure the keys are nearby. Like, he's losing his grip.
Right.
So on the keys, so to speak. But I love that scene with when he talks about all the greats and Miller says, "Yeah, they're all dead except me." And then Miller says, "How old are you?" to Hopkins. And he says, "Old enough to know better, young enough to do it again."
That's right. It's great. It almost feels like something Bo Hopkins just made up on the spot.
Yeah, it totally does. It totally does. And I love, he's got another great line. "How about them coochie dances? The ones with tassels on their nips."
He's great in this movie. I mean, if it wasn't for Miller being so great in this movie, he's easily the best thing in this film.
I agree, 100%. And when you get those two together, kind of juxtapositioning, and the way the tension's building and it's building, and Hopkins is getting nicer and Miller's getting more mistrustful, it just works so wonderfully.
Yeah.
Just a couple more moments, a couple more things, subtle things, but the lighting. Early on, the oppressive heat and the concrete of kind of old, decrepit downtown L.A. is really worked as a character, and it works really well.
Uh-huh.
Whereas when they get out to the cabin, or as we say in Canada, the cottage, the lighting is softer. It's more natural. It's not as oppressive. Just a subtle thing, but it's really good. And just the final thing, there's a scene near the end of the film, a shot of some legs flailing around.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like Tarantino, I feel like he lifted that beat for beat or sort of nods to it in Kill Bill with Buck. Oh,
yeah, I have no doubt. Honestly, right. I have no doubt because I know this is a favorite of his. So oh, yeah. I have no doubt. I mean, this feels like a, if you're a Quentin Tarantino fan, it doesn't have, again, it doesn't have the sardonic humor that Tarantino films have. Mm-hmm. Although Bo Hopkins does feel like he's coming like right out of a Tarantino movie.
He does.
But I mean, it this movie, to me, it feels like a Tarantino film.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. Those are all my notes. So just Hopkins is like this big smiling shark wearing lots of coats with lots of patches and a cowboy hat.
Yeah. So I wanted to give the MVT to Hopkins. Because, you know, he just recently passed away, and I love him in this movie. I really do. And he is one of the major players in this film. But I don't think I've ever given it to Jason Miller, and I don't know if I ever would, because he doesn't have a lot of film performances. Mm-hmm. Mulligan does a great job here, but Mulligan, I think, has also made better films than this, even though I do think this is one of his great films and one of the great lost 70s crime films. I do mean that. So I'm going to give it to Jason Miller here because he's really that good. Although Eric Ross, his screenplay is really good. I mean, this movie is very well written and a lot of conversations had. Make or break, again, for me, it's the moment when he realizes that his shelf life is over. It's the moment that he realizes, you know what? I got to get out of this game or they're going to take me out. And he kind of realizes they're going to take me out. And it's pretty much the scene where he's sitting in the office, I think, and Hopkins is just kind of talking.
Yeah.
And he's waiting for him to come out of the bathroom. Remember, he kind of reaches down for a gun or whatever. Or he reaches into his jacket, I think.
And then he puts it in the jacket.
Yeah. So he knows that his time is up. It's great. It's a great moment in this movie. And really, the movie kicks off from that point on. It's good up until that point, too, but that really helps it. I'm going to go 8.5 on this thing.
Nice.
I really think it's good. I mean, it's really good. It's, again, it's a lost classic, this film. And people should definitely check it out. If you can't see it any other way, there is YouTube. I don't think it diminishes the film. I still had a wonderful time watching it on YouTube. So I highly recommend this movie.
Very nice. Very nice. My make or break, I'm going to kind of cheat, not cheat because I do think it's earned, but I'm going to give it to the first Seaman Hopkins and Miller meet because it just, they play off each other so wonderfully and we're still trying to feel out Hopkins' intent through Miller.
Yeah.
And Miller is very weary of him, not only because of the possibility of him killing him, but just sort of that thing, much like a sports team, like this is the hot young rookie and he's going to come in and take my starting spot, right? Like there's uh-huh. There's that whole pecking order kind of law of the jungle thing where now Miller's got to be weary of this, right? So right. It's just a wonderful scene, wonderfully played. MVT, same as you, I got to go Miller. I think Miller is one of the sad what ifs, mm-hmm. even though he had a, you know, decent career. I just think he is such a tremendous actor. And we should say, we've said it on the show before, Jason Patrick's father.
Yes. Yeah, he, I mean, he only did 26 films. He really worked his whole career to get, for a long time, to get the championship season made, I think, is the film he directed.
Yeah.
He really wanted to, I think it was that his play or something?
I know that he was tied
yeah.
into
it. Yeah, that's his own play, I think. So he really worked his whole career to get that made, and that didn't perform too well either. So he was just a, you know, a stage guy. He just didn't do a whole lot of stuff. He did, like, you know,
he did a lot of junk near the end of his career, which stuff we would get a kick out of. But yeah,
he's really good in Exorcist 3. Remember we talked about him a little bit because he pops up in that for a little while.
He plays Ara Parsegian, legendary Notre Dame coach, in Rudy.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. He is in Rudy.
Oh yeah, so he's got some fun stuff, but he made some junky stuff that is our up alley for fun reasons, but I'm sure he would maybe, you know, not think it's his finest hour. But
I think he would have wanted a different career, a more prestige career with more challenging roles. But I don't think he's
deserving of it.
Yeah. I think after The Exorcist, which was his first film, his film debut, I don't think he ever really reached those levels again for him personally.
An Oscar, right?
Yeah, maybe. I think so. But I don't think it ever. I don't think it ever reached that level for him again. I mean, we've come to love people who love movies have come to love some of the stuff he's done. But I think he got a taste of the great stuff too early.
Yeah,
might have been the problem there.
No, I agree with you on that, and it's a sad kind of what if, right? Mm-hmm, so, my score for the film, just a touch lower than yours, is an 8.25 out of 10. I love this film. I'm glad that you love this film. I hope that I'm sure most of our listeners will love this film. And I wish someone would put it out. I'll buy it. Like, this will be a day one purchase for me.
Yeah, it needs to be put out on HD copy. It really does. Yeah, I mean, if I had my own label, I'd put this out. This would be one I'd argue for, like, one of the first five I'd put out.
Oh, yeah, 100%, dude.
Yeah, definitely. All right, that's our thoughts on The Nickel Ride. Check it out. Again, it's available out there on DVD. I don't know if it's still in print or not. I didn't look, to be frank.
I saw it on Amazon for, like, $17-$18, so it looks like it's still in print.
Okay, so you can get it that way. Or you can watch it on YouTube.
It's not bad either, we should say.
Yeah. No, it's not bad. It's just got a bad title.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anytime when you got a title that you know that one film guy that 44% and 100% dead or whatever it is? When you got a title like that, it's just so strange.
I mix it up with there's like a Jean-Louis Trintignant film that it's got some ridiculous kind of numerical fixture in the title too, where I kind of mix up those two.
Yeah, but he also recently just passed away.
Yeah,
everybody's passing away, man.
Whoa, really?
Yeah. I believe he did.
When did he die?
I don't know. I'm looking right now.
Oh, looks like I'm gonna cry on the air, man.
Don't cry on the air, please don't.
Oh.
June 17th this year.
Oh man.
11 days ago.
I didn't know that.
Yep. 11 days ago.
And we're going to have to talk off the air. If I was going to make a list of my top 10 all-time favorite actors, he's in the conversation.
Nice.
Wow. That's terrible.
Yeah, it is. But he lived a nice long life. He's 91. 91. So it's a good run.
That is a good run.
Good run there. We think we're going to have a guest on next week, and we think we know the film we're going to be covering, but we don't know enough to say right now.
So, well, just I can, if you'd like, I can confirm on air. I've spoken to this person.
Since okay, go ahead. I'll let you confirm it.
There's a gentleman who we're good friends with. He's been on the show before. Why? How many times? Once? I think he's been on for...
Two or three times, I'm sure. He did the Return of the Living Deads with us, and he did a couple Indian jams with us, a couple Bollywood films that he picked out for us. And maybe he's been on once or twice other than that. I don't know. But he's always kind of been in the background. He's part of the posse.
Yeah, he absolutely is, man. He's a guy that when I see he's watched some, he reps for something, I'm in. I'll be able to dive in head first. He gave us a few different choices, all of which would have been rad. I'm sure we can cover each of them over the next, year or two. But the one that Sammy and I kind of feel like, well, let's do this because we love this filmmaker. And in Josh's words, I think he said it's fucking awesome or fucking amazing. It's a Japanese film, Tetsuya Nakashima's It Comes from 2018.
This sounds ominous, that title. So for those who don't know, this is the same director as Kamikaze Girls, World of Kanako, and Confessions.
This would be Nakashima's fourth film of ours on the show?
I don't know if we ever talked about Confessions. I know it made my top 10 one year, I think.
Yep.
I love it a lot, and it's still, I think, underseen.
Oh, yeah.
Kanako's got a bit of a following, so people know about that one. And, of course, Kamikaze Girls is a bit of a cult film, and we covered that a long time ago. But
back in the day.
Yeah. But this, I wondered what he had done after Kanako, and now I know this one. Yep. And he hasn't done anything for a few years since then. But finally, I'm going to get to find out what he did after, because I loved Kanako. I mean, I loved that film.
It's so good.
Yeah.
It was the heart. If you think hardcore was the Heart of Darkness, Kanako takes that Heart of Darkness and takes it, 400 feet under the sea, even dark.
Yeah, it's dark. It's a good one. I don't know if we ever covered it. I think we just kind of talked about it. You had seen it. I think you might have seen it at TIFF or something.
I did. I think Scott Clickers and I did. And boy, we came out of there battered and bruised.
Yeah. And then I saw it like a couple years later. It finally hit home video. And I was kind of blown away by it. And yeah, we just never talked about it. But anyway, that's what we're doing. It comes. And good friend of the show, Josh Hurtado, is coming back on the show for it. He'll be hanging out with us. So.
Yeah.
Look forward to it. Hopefully we'll have a good time. We always do when Josh is on. I've been trying to get him on for a while. Even when you were out, we were trying to get him on, but we just couldn't make the schedules work. I know he wanted to talk Total Recall. I know he wanted to talk a couple other things, but we just couldn't make it work. He's a busy guy, so.
Very busy.
We'll get him on, and we'll get going. Hopefully everything will work out. I don't have anything else. You guys stay safe out there. The world is a treacherous place. And stay in the house and watch movies if you have to avoid some of that treachery.
That's right. The bum whiffery. Avoid the bum whiffery when you can.
Yeah, if there's a lot of bum whiffery going on, go back in the house. Whiff your own bum.
Whiff your own bum or someone else's bum that
you're close to. Yeah.
You're close to, of course. And avoid smiling men in patchy jackets and cowboy hats.
Yes, that is a yes. Very wise move. Yeah, definitely. All right, I'll say adios.
Adios.
He's trying to think of something Southern to say there or something.
No, I just was thinking of Bo.
Adios there, Mr. Cooper.
Yeah. Or the shark.
The shark. Yeah.
I think shark.
Did you guys like the nickel ride?
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com, and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.